Good evening, everyone. I'm very pleased to welcome you here to the second annual BJS lecture. Last year, we considered public sociology, which was a topic that prompted a very lively debate here in the LSE and also subsequently in the journal pages, as you may have seen. Now, this year, we're turning our attention to public intellectuals and British sociology. And this is a topic which we're hoping will stimulate another lively BJS debate, both tonight and subsequently over the coming year in the journal again. This is a popular topic, as many of you may have noticed. Prospect magazine is asking people to vote for the world's top five global public intellectuals. Worth looking at the list. It's very male. And it also just has three sociologists on the list, one of whom is British, Tony Giddens, who apologizes for not being here this evening. But why there might only be one British sociologist on the list is a topic that Brian had already identified 9 months ago as something we should be discussing, so he was ahead of his time. Timing's perfect, in fact. And this evening he's going to address that topic in what I think promises to be a very provocative lecture and talk, which he hopes will provoke you. Some of you will disagree with him and discuss it and debate it afterwards. Brian really probably needs very little introduction. He's currently Professor of Sociology at the Asia Research Institute at the National University of Singapore, where he's research leader of the cluster on religion and globalization. Until earlier this year, he was professor at the University of Cambridge, Professor of Sociology. He's the author, as many of you will know, of numerous publications, the founding editor of three journals. I take my hat off to him for that one. And he's currently writing a three-volume study of the sociology of religion and also editing the Dictionary of Sociology for Cambridge University Press. So he's keeping very, very busy. We're very pleased that he would agree to come here this evening, and we look forward to his lecture. So thank you, Brian, for coming.
Well, many thanks to the journal for its generous support, and in particular to Jackie Gauntlet, who, amongst other jobs, has been looking after me and arranging much of this evening's talk. I'm a person of small stature, so I'm standing up so that I can see you a bit more easily. This lecture I want to give is fairly critical of sociology, British sociology. But in a way, I'd like to say at the beginning that in a sense this is a sort of self-critical lecture, because most of the weaknesses that I identify in this paper, I think, would apply to me at least. And it's slightly pessimistic, although I think there's a lot of good things going on in British sociology at the moment. I wanted to use the history of British sociology since roughly 1945 as a sort of pretext or context within which to think about what the contribution of sociology has been to the analysis of major issues in British society, and to try to give some sort of evaluation of its successes and failures over this period, and eventually to identify possibly some steps forward that might be appropriate or useful. As Bridget says, I have been editing the Cambridge Dictionary for some time, and almost out of idle curiosity have read as many dictionaries as I could find, and handbooks and so on and so forth. And one of my favourite handbooks is Gurvitch and Moore, 1945, called 20th Century Sociology, in which the entry on British sociology is written by a man called Jay Rumney. And his comment on British sociology, I think, is quite interesting and quite telling, and to my mind, still very relevant today. And here is a small quote from this chapter, from this rather traditional handbook. "Sociology as an independent discipline is still not too firmly established in England, although what may be called the sociological approach has long been in existence, going back as far as at least the 18th century. Perhaps the reason lies in the fact that sociology is essentially the product of rapid social change and crisis. But England has been a country of stability and gradual change, of reform and evolution, rather than of crisis and revolution. This meant that at no time were the foundations of social life closely scrutinized. What analysis there was piecemeal, haphazard, and unsystematic. Jay Runney received a PhD from the London School of Economics in 1933. He became Professor of Sociology at the University of Newark. In 1934, he published a book called Herbert Spencer's Sociology. And by 1945, when he wrote this chapter on British sociology, he was working on the sociology of war. The following lecture being my lecture, can be regarded in a way as a sort of footnote to Rumney's excellent and perspicacious insight into British sociology and the evolutionary history of the British Isles. I've normally worked on the assumption that the first 15 minutes of any lecture is crucial, or are crucial, and therefore I'm going to present the argument of this lecture this evening in the first 15 minutes. Some of you might drift off a little bit as you think about the first 15 minutes, and then I'll try and pull the lecture together. So what I'm going to state is the argument and then sort of unpick it and add bits and pieces to it. But in broad terms, what I want to say, in a sense, is fairly conventional, I think. First, British social science has depended heavily on the migration of intellectuals, especially Jewish intellectuals, who were primarily refugees from fascism. In this sense, Britain has largely imported its public intellectuals. Secondly, it appears to follow from this historical fact that intellectual innovation requires massive, disruptive, violent change. Intellectual effervescence does not appear to flow from a society that is in a steady social state. Third, British sociology did nevertheless give rise to a distinctive tradition of social criticism, in which one can argue that there were typically homegrown public intellectuals. The main theme of their social criticism, which dominated the 1960s and 1970s, was to consider the constraining and divisive impact of social class, race, and gender on the egalitarian enjoyment of post-war expanding social citizenship. Fourth, post-war British sociology came to be dominated by the analysis of an affluent consumer society, and with the resulting decline of the strong programme of class analysis, it became increasingly difficult for British sociologists in particular, and public intellectuals more generally, to articulate a meaningful critique of post-war affluence and post-war leisure society. While many clung to an increasingly outdated idiom of class inequality as a discourse, new paradigms were explored and developed in media and communication studies, film theory, dance studies, etc. The umbrella term for these multidisciplinary projects was simply cultural studies, but I'd want to argue that these studies are simply a diluted form of the sociology of culture. Insofar as critical cultural studies or critical cultural sociology had a theoretical tradition, it was closely associated with the Frankfurt School's critical response to American consumerism. Finally, the main failure of British sociology, in my view, in the post-war period, and possibly the failure of British public intellectuals as a whole, was a failure to develop a sustained macro-sociological analysis of the historical decline of the United Kingdom as a world power in the 20th century. British sociology has become a technically sophisticated and theoretically advanced social science, but it has failed, in my view, to produce a significant systematic analysis of British society as a whole. The possible exceptions to this argument raise some interesting paradoxes. On the one hand, some of the interesting insights into British society have come from broadly outsiders, who have been largely concerned with post-colonial Britain and the problem of racial identity, such as C.L.R. James, V.S. Naipaul, John Rex, Stuart Hall, and Paul Gilroy. Another distinctive cohort has been concerned with the peculiarities of British culture and existed to some extent outside British academic social science, namely the New Left Review intellectuals, in particular Perry Anderson, Tom Nairn, Robin Blackburn, and Juliet Mitchell. We might identify a third cohort of conservative public intellectuals who either mourn the passing of a romantic imperial past, such as Enoch Powell or more recently Roger Scruton, or who understood the crisis of post-war conservative Britain and rejected it, namely George Orwell. It's not specifically my intention to offer an analysis of the history of British sociology or to undertake a systematic study of its achievements and limitations. This has all been done, I think, by Banks and Halsey and others. In this discussion, by contrast, the history of British sociology can be employed, as I've said, as a device for considering the political nature of intellectual life in modern Britain. My thesis is that the growth of sociology as a critical theory and the rise of public intellectuals are closely connected with political crises that require a collective, dynamic response that amounts to a process of nation building. We might also take examples from the crisis of the Habsburg Empire that produced major Hungarian social scientists who were quite clearly public intellectuals, such as George Lukács, Karl Mannheim, or Mészáros. Another European example, I think, would be the whole wave of Polish migrants to social science out of a society that was in a state of more or less permanent crisis. Zieniecki, Ossowski, Ossowska, Kolakowski, Zygmunt Bauman, and so forth. In the contemporary world, sociology, to my mind, appears to be re-emerging and flourishing in places where there is major social change, political crisis, instability, in particular Turkey, India, and China. Whether or not British sociology has or can produce major intellectual figures may, in fact, not be the most interesting or important sociological question. The sociology of intellectual creativity may be a more promising start for us. The strength and weakness of British sociology is probably parallel to the strength and weakness of British culture as a whole. The absence of public intellectuals is not a psychological failure of British thinkers. It's not a lack of will or responsibility. We do not have public intellectuals because we do not have a social space for them. In sociological terms, we do not need to look for the availability of the role rather than asking questions about possible inhabitants. In Britain, we do not seem to produce currently or have institutions or traditions that would sustain people like a Noam Chomsky or a Karl Marx or a Karl Mannheim. The question partly requires an analysis of the cultural environment of intellectual activity in Britain. Namely, we need to consider the peculiarities of the English to understand the conditions that produce good sociology and influential intellectuals. The argument that I'm presenting, obviously, is that periods of great intellectual creativity are normally associated with great and dramatic periods of social change, especially political revolutions. What I'll call the Anderson thesis remains probably the most promising account of the strengths and weaknesses of English intellectual culture. As you know, in a series of articles, Perry Anderson, 1968, 64, 1990, developed a historical argument that the revolutionary conflicts of the 17th century resulted in the constitutional compromise of Lockean liberalism, and that the gradualism and individualism of British history has not favoured a creative or critical intellectual elite. 20th century critical social theory in Britain was largely produced by refugee Jewish intellectuals fleeing from persecution, and the gradual disappearance of that generation is reflected in the erosion, I think, of the intellectual excitement of much of sociology in modern Britain, and to a large extent in the United States. It was, of course, not just Jewish or European migrants, but many came from South Africa and the West Indies. We lack public intellectuals because we lack a vibrant public culture that is shaped by critical social philosophy or critical theory. The underdevelopment of British social theory is a consequence of this historical gradualism, a culture of compromise, an abortive or premature revolution, the presence of evolutionary thought and individualism. The Restoration was a compromise that put an end to civil war and set the scene for Locke's liberal theory of government, tolerance, and social contract. From the perspective of this new left review generation, the origins of the present crisis rest on the social and political conditions that have produced a political social process of gradualism. In other words, I think that this Anderson thesis is rather like the argument presented by Jay Rumney in the Gurvitch and Moore 20th century sociology. This analysis of British post-war intellectual culture is well known and to some extent a conventional view. I have four initial criticisms of this picture of British intellectual life that take me into a more substantive view of our current condition. Firstly, this view involves, I think, inevitably a romantic vision of the intellectual as essentially an outsider with a radical, if not specifically socialist, agenda. The notion of public intellectual has this characteristically romantic flavour. It means an intellectual who struggles against overwhelming odds to deliver an overwhelmingly important social analysis that is received by an audience that requires a message that will give expression to their lives and their problems. Public intellectuals tend to be associated, therefore, with political causes, especially revolutionary struggles and colonial, post-colonial violence. The public intellectual is an alienated outsider who struggles heroically against oppression and injustice. This interpretation of the intellectual was obviously favoured, for example, by Edward Said, who, for obvious reasons, in his 1993 Reith Lectures, published as Representations of the Intellectual, wanted to adopt this position vis-a-vis the notion of exile and intellectual authenticity. This popular image, which was historically epitomised by Antonio Gramsci, more recently by Edward Said, and more currently by Antonio Negri, is sociologically, I think, unhelpful and historically misleading. Perhaps the interesting feature of British intellectuals is that they've often been conservatives rather than radicals in the traditional sense, such that any historical account of British politics and society would have to include Edmund Burke's Reflections, Samuel Taylor Coleridge's On the Constitution, or F.R. Leavis's The Great Tradition and the Common Pursuit as major contributions to British intellectual culture. Secondly, there was an important period of major social change after the Second World War, and one can argue that the contributions of British sociology to public culture were to study the consequences, limitations, and failures of the Keynesian Revolution and the rise of the welfare state. British sociologists were driven by the question of social inequality and social justice, that is, the limits of social citizenship, as described by T.H. Marshall in the famous lecture, Citizenship and Social Class. Sociologists came to be concerned with three limitations imposed by social stratification on this Marshallian vision of citizenship, namely social class, gender, and race. Sociologists, I think, did make major contributions to public debate about class opportunity and inequality, for example, in the health report, the Black Report of 1980, or research on education and social mobility with the Oxford Mobility Study. And there are, I think, good grounds for arguing that Peter Laslett, Peter Townsend, Davidson, Peter Wilmot, Michael Young and others, Tom Harrison and Charles Madge, for example, were public intellectuals and that they were publicly engaged with major issues of public culture, social change, equality and so forth, and created lasting and important institutions such as Mass Observation, the University of the Third Age, the Open University, the Workers' Education Association, and so forth. The fact that many of these intellectuals do not entirely fit the new left review of public intellectuals should not encourage us to dismiss this generation of social scientists as merely bourgeois reformers. Thirdly, if the migration of Jewish intellectuals to British shores constituted the foundations of post-war social science in such figures as Norbert Elias, Ludwig Wittgenstein, Ilya Neustadt, we should look equally to the hordes of British social scientists who migrated to North America, the Commonwealth and elsewhere, and still contribute to something that we'd have to call British sociology. So there's a problem in this lecture about how one defines Britishness and whether writers such as Michael Mann, Robert Holton, Stuart Clegg, Ian Taylor, Barry Hindus, John Heritage and so forth are expats writing British sociology who happen to live somewhere else, or whether they are genuinely no longer part of a British sociological culture or a British public culture. And there are many other figures I think are particularly interesting in trying to get a handle on this exchange, as it were, of intellectuals, such as Roland Robertson and John O'Neill. The question about how to define Britishness actually raises a more interesting conceptual issue about the rise of global sociology and to what extent one could continue to talk about British sociology or Australian sociology or Canadian sociology. And of course, the idea of the British Journal of Sociology therefore becomes problematic, I think. Why no Commonwealth sociology? Why no association of British sociology that's global rather than merely local or national? Finally, let's turn to the argument that major social change is at least one condition for the rise of public intellectuals. Was there no such post-war crisis to create a dynamic post-war intellectual culture in Britain? In response to this question, the history of post-war British sociology could be divided into three, possibly four phases. The study of the limitations, particularly social class, on citizenship. The rise of consumer society and the study of leisure and lifestyle. Postmodernism and the cultural turn. And the emergence, possibly, of an incipient fourth stage with the crisis of multiculturalism, political terrorism, and the problem of identity in both Britain and in other Commonwealth cultures. All four stages, I think, have been characterized by the decline of Britain as a major military and imperial power, and secondly, as a significant economic power. What is peculiar, I want to argue this evening, about British sociology, and more generally about British public intellectuals, is that the decline of Britain as a major power did not appear to produce any sustained or detailed or critical debate about these macro-sociological changes. In this respect, the subdued mood of post-war British sociology seems to reflect the mood of a post-war Britain. So I'm sort of raising the question about, I've said that I think, following Rumney and others and Anderson, that I think that the absence of major violent forms of social change in Britain seems to me to be associated with the absence of critical intellectuals, unlike Germany or France or Hungary or Poland. But there does seem to me to be a major structural historical change of British society, which is simply the decline of Britain as an imperial power. And this seems to me to be strangely absent from much of the reflections of British sociology on British culture and British history. And I'm making no normative or evaluative judgment about empire. I'm simply saying that the empirical disappearance of empire seems to have produced no significant debate in British sociology. In the book, There Ain't No Black in the Union Jack, Paul Gilroy argues in the new introduction, in particular to the 1992 version, that this post-war period was characterized by nostalgia and melancholy about the loss of empire. Gilroy claims that the race relations situation in Britain was, quote, overdetermined by Britain's painful loss of empire, and that the country's communities of the strange and alien are still sometimes at risk of being engulfed by the profound cultural and psychological consequences of decline, which is evident in many levels, economic and material, as well as cultural and psychological. In my view, there was no neurosis, no melancholy, no nostalgia, no waving goodbye with tears to British Empire, but on the contrary, a period in which Britain really walked away from empire with relatively little social conflict, I think. Although some politicians, in particular Enoch Powell, wanted to hang on to India, the British government had managed to keep Indian society behind the British war effort with the promise of post-war independence, and British public opinion did not favour, I would argue, prolonged military adventures overseas. Powell, who claimed to love India and wanted to defend it against possible invasion from the Soviet Union, remained an oddity in British politics. The British public wanted peace and post-war reconstruction, not the fantasy of colonial prestige that had been originally invented by Victorian leaders like Disraeli. More importantly, it was evident to most industrialists that colonialism was no longer a profitable strategy, and that a return on investment might be better served by more indirect means. Macmillan's pragmatism, as illustrated in the famous Wind of Change speech to the Parliament of the Union of South Africa on African decolonization and political change in February 1960, was in fact based upon a popular mood of post-war domestic stability. There was little enthusiasm for overseas military adventures, and British resources had in any case been stretched to the limit by the war. My argument, contrary to Paul Gilroy, is therefore that what is peculiar about British public life, and hence its intellectual life, is the absence of any serious sustained public discussion of what post-colonialism means and what the loss of empire entailed. It is this silence rather than the melancholy that I find surprising, and it results in the absence, I want to argue, of any significant macro-historical sociological study of the loss of empire, the devolution of government, the economic decline of Britain, the changing colonial structure, and the future of its constitutional position. The indictment, if any, there is to be one of on British sociology, is the weakness of any vision of the whole social process of Britain in the world and its place. And despite the endless talk recently of globalization and global society, there seems to me to be a relatively little empirical analysis of Britain's place in this global process. And more domestically, even that most peculiar of British institutions, the monarchy, has received relatively little attention in this transnational context, apart possibly from Tom Nairn's The Enchanted Glass. Why is this? Gilroy and Anderson argue that it's the anti-intellectualism and individualism of British culture that contributes to a failure to see ourselves with any level of significance or seriousness. Against this view, there is another more specific answer. The legacy of Macmillan's conservatism was that Britain fought few significant post-colonial wars. There was no Algeria, no Mozambique, no Congo. The Suez Crisis of 1956 merely confirmed that military adventures without American support would in future only end in absurdity. Anthony Eden's mismanagement of British military and diplomatic intervention in Egypt only served to further alienate public opinion and confirmed the view that the burdens of empire were undesirable and unsustainable. Britain walked out of Africa and Asia almost without a trace, I want to argue, of nostalgia. And the post-war boom created a consumer society in which the language of class struggle no longer appeared relevant or convincing. Post-war British affluence was largely successful in creating aspirations and expectations of social mobility and higher incomes. Although objectively Britain continued to be profoundly unequal in terms of income distribution and health, for example, the mood of affluence and the fact of peace made both the rhetoric of class analysis and the language of heroic intellectualism difficult to sustain. Britain kept out of serious of African post-colonial wars, learnt the lesson of Suez, and avoided any involvement in Vietnam, an involvement which in America and Australia and elsewhere produced profound social change and I think contributed to an entirely different sort of intellectual environment. The events of 1968 did not produce in Britain anyway any great intellectual effervescence, unlike France, Germany and Italy. I think my two colleagues, Nick Abercrombie and Steve Hill, probably occupied a room at some stage in the LSE during 1968, and that was probably the only time they kind of got involved in such serious political activity. But basically, 1968 events, I don't think, got to the provinces in the UK and was largely confined to protests, I think, in and around Lancaster and London. The Falklands War of 1982, I think, was a major political success for the Thatcher government and paved the way for the Conservative victory of 1983. But the war was short and, I think, anachronistic. It confirmed the reluctance of successive British governments to become entangled in problematic colonial wars. The current Blair situation I'll comment on at the very end of the lecture. While sociologists might continue to talk about, to quote Halsey, class-ridden prosperity, it was prosperity rather than class-ridden poverty that characterized post-war Britain. It was this mood of what I'd call passive consumerism that explains much of the absence of a decisive role for public intellectuals and perhaps underlines the modest achievements of much of British sociology. Margaret Thatcher's There Is No Such Thing as Society was clearly ideological, but it contained some recognition. But it contained some recognition that the language of class was no longer valid as a rhetoric of political action and intellectual critique. In this climate of consumerism, much of the best sociology in Britain has been small-scale, qualitative and descriptive. It included, I think, the classically small-scale studies of the disappearance of community and class, in such beautifully summarized works as Richard Hoggart's The Uses of Literacy. For a variety of reasons, it's the social historians who have seen the bigger picture. And I think this vacuum has created an intellectual space for what Chris Rojack and I have called decorative sociology. That is a sociology without significant moral purchase or political vision of society, a sociology dominated by the cultural turn, which I think has resulted in very microscopic studies of the impact of soaps on TV programs, and has not contributed to a historical or comparative view of British society or any society in a global environment. It has nothing to say about the impact of war, violence or conflict or technological change in modern society. And again, going back to Jay Rumney, who you can guess is my intellectual hero for this evening, the fact that Jay Rumney was going to write a book on the sociology of war seems to me to put him in my list of global intellectuals. Some of the peculiarities of British sociology, going into a bit more detail, I think, are that the peculiarity of British sociology is that whilst its professional development has been somewhat slow and uncertain, it has produced, I think, a rich if heterogeneous body of sociological scholarship, despite my criticisms of this lack of a historical global picture. In short, the paradox of British, unlike American sociology, is that it has flourished, with the possible exception of the LSE, in marginal, typically parochial universities, and it's been carried out by people and institutions who have not been overtly or necessarily connected to mainstream sociology departments. Sociology may have been well represented at the LSE through the 20th century, but it's not flourished at Oxford or Cambridge. By contrast, it's enjoyed a distinguished history in such places as Leicester, Lancaster, Liverpool, Essex, Warwick, Edinburgh. Leicester, I think, has been especially significant in producing the academic home of Rosemary Crompton, Eric Dunning, Norbert Elias, Anthony Giddens, John Goldthorpe, Ilya Neustadt, and others. I think another example would be something like the successes of the sociology of deviance, the York University Deviancy Symposium in the 1970s, which attracted such figures as Stan Cohen, Mike Hepworth, Ian Taylor, Paul Walton, Jock Young, and others. Critical criminology flourished in these more provincial universities in opposition to Cambridge criminology, which was primarily funded by Home Office grants, and whose intellectual focus was articulated by Sir Leonard Radzinovich. Perhaps the most influential social philosopher of the period, Alistair MacIntyre, had also been a lecturer at Leeds before becoming a professor of sociology at the University of Essex. MacIntyre's style of social philosophy, in my taste, represented British sociology at its most thoughtful and provocative. His penetrating insights into British religious culture were beautifully illustrated in such works as The Secularization and Moral Change, Marxism and Christianity, and with Paul Ricoeur, The Religious Significance of Atheism. MacIntyre's unique blend of philosophical reflection, scrupulous analysis, and critical social insight has remained a positive characteristic, I think, of British sociology. The only contemporary representative, possibly, of that strong philosophical tradition is represented by the Polish-born Zygmunt Bauman, whose many publications continue to probe the moral consequences of postmodern society. Britain, on the whole, I think, or British sociology, has often acted as a sort of social conduit between continental European social philosophy and North American intellectual fields. Rather like Britain being a nation of small shopkeepers, so we've also been a nation of small intellectuals, possibly trading ideas from continental Europe and selling them to the United States, with some value-added process, possibly. This intermediary role has been particularly important in the area of social theory. One can think of the ways in which French social theory, Louis Althusser, Pierre Bourdieu, Baudrillard, Foucault, Derrida, Aron, Boudin, etc., etc., have been received in Britain before being transported to North America. And it's a great pity that Anthony Giddens isn't here, because I want to talk a little bit about his place in all of this, since Giddens has obviously been a controversial figure, and there has been a sort of pastime of criticising Giddens for his contributions or non-contribution to British sociology. But I think his work has been very dominant, particularly obviously in the field of social theory. And for many people of my generation, his Capitalism and Modern Social Theory, of course, was very distinctive and influential. The agency and structure debate of the constitution of society, I think, was particularly important. And it's interesting, as Bridget was pointing out, Giddens is in this list of global intellectuals. And whether one likes it or not, the third way debate was a significant input of British sociology into contemporary politics. However, I think that the strength and weakness of Giddens' sociology but reflects the problems and achievements of post-war British sociology as a whole. I think his sociological theories tend to be very eclectic, and he draws heavily on European sociology as part of this sort of intellectual conduit. And in particular, his recent work, I think, is heavily dependent on the work of Ulrich Beck. There's nothing wrong with dependency on other writers, and there's nothing wrong in drawing heavily on other people's work. But I think, from my point of view, this reproduces, as it were, the peculiar status of British sociology as this conduit between continental high church social theory and the more empirical behavioural sociology of North America. We're a sort of intermediary trader, modifying the excesses of continental social theory and making it palatable to a North American audience. That's how I'd see it. I think, secondly, that Giddens has not produced, to my mind, a major macro sociological analysis of British society, and his work is quite definitely theoretical rather than empirical. There is no, I don't think, large empirical project behind Anthony Giddens' theoretical work. Thirdly, I think he's promoted social theory rather than sociological theory. And I often think that social theory is simply a watered-down version of something more sharper, more scholarly, and more definite called sociological theory. His theoretical framework, furthermore, I think, is dominated more by social psychology than by sociology as such. And the importance of what Stephen Loyal has called the autonomous individual agent in Giddens' sociological theory seems to me to reflect this strong emphasis on the individual and individualism and the psychology of social action rather than the sociology of it. I think these concerns are very clearly reflected in such works as Modernity and Self-Identity and the Transformation of Intimacy. Despite criticisms of social theory and sociological theory, both have remained important and influential components of British intellectual culture, particularly in the work of John Rex and also in the work of David Lockwood. Post-war British sociology was therefore largely, I think, dependent on much of the French legacy of structuralism, European Marxism, and more recently, this strong impact of Heidegger on social theory in Britain and elsewhere. The professional myth that Talcott Parsons' 1953 Marshall lectures at Cambridge University impeded the development of academic sociology in Britain for about three decades is very difficult to eradicate. These lectures at Cambridge, and I kept bumping into people who were at least 90, who kept saying, you know, that terrible man Parsons, you know, he's done awful things to British social thought. And they were sort of locked in this time warp of trying to make sense of this man's lectures on economic theory. And for those of us who have worked at Cambridge, it was a great burden to have to cope with this geriatric critique of Parsonian functionalism. I think Parsons was both criticised and maligned. While C. Wright Mills's The Sociological Imagination dominated much of the British view of socially relevant theory, at a later stage, Peter Berger and Thomas Luckman's influential The Social Construction of Reality came to be a very critical weapon in British political and social theory as a critical discipline, despite the fact, I think, that Berger and Luckmann's Social Construction of Reality is a profoundly conservative book. It is a defense of social order above all else. Because there are various people in the audience here, I would like to pay a tribute to the contribution of John Rex's Key Problems in Sociological Theory when Tony Woodiwiss and I were young boys, not young men, but young boys at the University of Leeds. This was the thing to read and made a profound impact on the use of Max Weber's sociology in the analysis of class and race in British society. And also, I think, that much neglected figure of British sociological theory, Alan Dorr, his lectures on the two sociologies provided both a sociological insight into theory, but also a political map for applying sociological theory to critical issues such as anti-apartheid movements, CND, and others. I'm beginning to run out of time, probably, so I'll have to cut short the central section of this paper. But just to summarise, what I wanted to say in the central part of this paper is that, of course, the substantial contribution of British sociology to sociology has been, first of all, I think, the analysis of social class, within which there were huge contributions from Dahrendorf, Michael Mann, Willis, Henriques, Lockwood, Goldthorpe, etc., etc. Secondly, I think a major contribution to the analysis of race relations. And thirdly, I think through the work of people like Anne Oakley, major contributions to debates, and Juliet Mitchell, to debates about gender. And I see these three components, race, gender, and class, as part of, as it were, the bread and butter, the mainstream of British sociology in the post-war period. And I regard all of these contributions as contributions to an analysis of the limitations of post-war citizenship in Britain, namely that income inequality, gender inequality, and race inequality were major barriers to the realization of Keynesian, Marshallian post-war reconstruction. And I think that that discourse or language of inequality and justice that's implicit in those three dimensions began to fail with the growth of consumer society, and therefore I'd see the cultural turn, the rise of journals such as Theory, Culture and Society, the great emphasis on cultural studies and leisure studies as essentially a response to the analysis of affluence post-social reconstruction, despite or notwithstanding Holles's comment about a class-ridden prosperity, that the new emphasis on media studies, affluence, leisure, and so forth, made to some extent the post-war analysis of social inequality increasingly somehow out of touch with this emerging leisure world. To come to a conclusion, I've been arguing that in the period from 1945 to 1968, British sociology was primarily concerned with post-war reconstruction. This involved the study of the implementation of this Keynesian economic revolution and the creation of the welfare state. This phase concluded, I think, with the first Thatcher administration of 1979-83. British sociology then became somewhat implicitly the study of the rise of consumer society and the decline of the old collectivist values that lay behind the Labour Party and the welfare state faded into the background. Thatcherism ushered in a new era of individualism, deregulation, entrepreneurial values, celebrating mobility, personal affluence, and was a sort of populist, anti-professional ideology that many sociologists, including myself, found it very difficult to cope with. New Labour and the Third Way politics have represented an attempt of the Labour Party to, in some sense, transform itself and to modernise itself and to adjust to this new consumerism. If T.H. Marshall was the theorist of the first wave of British sociology, Anthony Giddens was the sociologist of the second wave, and therefore it's a great pity that Tony Giddens isn't here this evening, because he could either deny or affirm this description of him that I'm offering. Let's return, therefore, to my favourite character this evening, Jay Rumney, and to his analysis of British sociology in 1944. He argued at the end of this chapter on British sociology that the gradual evolution of British society did not call forth and possibly did not need public intellectuals. Was he correct? My argument is that the loss of empire and the decline of Britain as a world power might have provoked a sense of social crisis that might have provoked a large-scale public intellectual sociology. Among conservative public figures, I think to some extent it did, but the great majority of the British public were content to wave it goodbye. Were there no real post-war crises? Perhaps the only significant one, I think, has been the mounting crisis of identity, race relations, and multiculturalism. And this afternoon I was back at Cambridge giving another public lecture called The End of Multiculturalism, in which I was speculating on the causes of the failure of Britain to become a successful multicultural society. Post-war British society, therefore, spans the final collapse of the British Empire and the decline of Britain as a world power. These conditions produced important generational differences and a specific consciousness that existed over and above specifically gender and class differences. These post-war generations lived through the Cold War, came to maturity in conditions of growing affluence, the decline of the trade unions, and the erosion of social class as the most important markers of identity. While these generations were always threatened by disasters, nuclear war, particularly in the European arena, they have been lived under conditions of relative peace. Military conscription, rationing of essential household items of clothing, food, barrack room drill, all of this came to an end in this period. Internationally, Aden, Suez, Kenya, and the Malaysian emergency were in fact merely military episodes that marked the decline of British military power. The Suez crisis, as I've tried to argue, demonstrated that Britain could no longer operate as a great power without American support or approval, and Britain consequently or subsequently withdrew from any further significant colonial adventures, including Mrs. Thatcher's, in retrospect, strange defence of British interests in the South Atlantic in the Falklands War. The pragmatism of Harold Macmillan, whose policies allowed Britain to avoid the confrontations that dominated colonial powers such as France, Portugal, and Belgium in the post-war period, made the decline of Britain possibly less painful than other European colonial powers, and I think explains partly why I believe Gilroy's analysis of this nostalgic neurosis doesn't actually work. In short, modern sociology has to be understood in terms of the rise and decline of a baby boomer generation. Their political activism was associated with CND and anti-apartheid movements, but their maturity was experienced in the context of affluence, leisure, and a consumer boom. There is, however, I believe, a new mood in British society in which the future looks much more insecure and the international role of Britain very unclear. The Iraq War and the London bombings in July 2005 confirmed these sentiments, I think, echoed by Macmillan. Oh, sorry, that the sentiments echoed by Macmillan, you've never had it so good, had in fact come to an end. This mood of uncertainty, I think, explains the popularity of Ulrich Beck's Risk Society, with its great emphasis on the explosion of risk with modernization and his catalogue of disasters that follow all periods of modernity. So the popularity of Beck, I think, and the negative aftermath of terrorist attacks in London and elsewhere raise difficult questions about the future of British race relations policy, about the possibility of multiculturalism, and raise, of course, especially this problematic relationship with Islam. Britain has been relatively successful in providing I think Britain has been relatively unsuccessful in providing a positive framework of multiculturalism, and I think Britain became a multicultural society largely by accident rather than design, And its liberalism is characterized, I think, by benign neglect rather than a positive policy of difference and multiculturalism. These social conflicts will make the sociological study of peace and war, civil violence, terrorism, a much more prominent feature of the future of British sociology and political science. I come back to London very regularly. I always go to the local bookshop, and I notice that the sociology shelves each year get smaller and smaller and smaller. And other shelves got bigger and bigger, such as women's studies, consumer studies, leisure studies. You've probably noticed that the growing shelf at the moment is terrorist studies. And I think this is obviously going to shape much of the future of British sociology. This whole historical period, I think, is therefore characterized by what I've elsewhere called in the BJS article, the erosion of citizenship in British society. The sociology of security and terrorism, therefore, will become the next growth area of sociological research and theory in Britain. And I think Macmillan and Sage will be taking notice of this. But insecurity will also include biological threats, and the globalization of new infectious diseases such as SARS or avian flu will create new types of consciousness, new social structures, new demands on sociology for which we ought to try to equip ourselves. The problem of the body and society, I think, will include the management of cloning and genetic modification. These new conditions, this new risk society, both of terrorism, biological innovation and change, may produce the sort of general crisis that one might suspect would create conditions for the emergence of a whole cohort of public intellectuals. So I'll finish on this note. The real failure, I think, of British sociology and by extension British intellectuals is the failure to produce any significant macro sociological analysis of British society and its decline. Are there other societies in which sociologists or public lecturers did in fact produce anything like the sorts of works that I'm trying to describe? Because it's no good me saying we lack a macro sociology of Britain if I can't sort of demonstrate that any other society produced anything worthwhile. But for my money, the examples might include Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, Max Weber's analysis of the Russian revolutions, Durkheim's Suicide, Leon Trotsky's The History of the Russian Revolution. Contenders in mid-century might include C. Wright Mills's Power Elite or E.P. Thompson's The Making of the English Working Class. If I'm critical of the failures of macro-historical sociology in Britain, it's necessary for me to produce some exemplars of what I think sociology should aspire to be or achieve, and therefore I conclude with a highly personal choice, my Desert Island discs of macro sociology that I would take to my Singaporean island to contemplate in my early retirement. These works, which are exemplary, are in alphabetical order rather than on an honorific order. And I think they'd include Perry Anderson's Lineages of the Absolute State, Robin Blackburn's Banking on Death or Investing in Life, Giovanni Arrighi's The Long 20th Century, Corrigan and Sayers' The Great Arch, Krishnan Kumar's recent The Making of English National Identity, or Michael Mann's Incoherent Empire. One argument against this conclusion might be that in a period of globalization, sociologists should not be writing about nation states and should not be writing about British society. But this criticism, I think, is weak in that globalization has not resulted, I don't think, in the erosion of nation states. On the contrary, globalization seems to have intensified claims about sovereignty and national coherence and authenticity. In any case, my argument includes the possibility of studying Britain in a global process or Britishness in a global cultural environment. So to quote finally from Jay Rumney, to bring myself full circle, at the end of this chapter on British sociology, he says, 1945, the great promise of sociology inherent in the 18th century was not fulfilled. And this was in many ways unfortunate, since Spencer's influence deflected attention from history, in which 18th century social thought was strong, to biology and biological explanations of complex social phenomena. so that for a time the survival of the fittest became synonymous with the survival of the richest. Preoccupied with the problems of the social organism, the general will and the social mind, it ignored Spencer's dictum, which he too ignored, that what biography is to anthropology, history is to sociology. It used comparative method, but not always critically, for the study of primitive society, but historical civilizations and contemporary society it overlooked. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Brian. You have clearly provoked some watching the faces from up here. So we have about half an hour for the discussion, so who wants to kick off the discussion? Could you say who you are when you ask questions? Thank you.
My name's Michael Williams. Could it be argued that the space for sociology, in which a macro-sociology might develop, has been crowded out by other disciplines, notably economics, history, which have both been dominant social sciences in Britain, social policy perhaps with the inheritance of the webs and beverage. And the second point is, when you say that there's no macro analysis of British decline, of course in the field of history there has been, and it's a central debate, the reasons for the British relative economic decline, with people like Anderson contributing to that debate, Eric Hobsbawm, Corelli Barnett, Martin Wiener. This is, you know, there has been a debate about this. It's surprising that it hasn't been overlooked by sociologists, that they haven't contributed to that debate, because it was a very central one. And of course, economists participated in that as well.
Well, I'm partly agreeing with you. I mean, I think that what Michael Mann represents, a sort of dying art, if you like, inside sociology, of a sort of macro historical sociological approach. And again, thinking about Cambridge, I mean, Cambridge is dominated by the social history group, and I think it's, you know, I partly agree with you that, you know, perhaps what we need now is another sort of explanation as to why history and economics and social history have been much more successful than sociologists. And the quote that I ended with at the end, Rumney, I think would, you know, is really kind of affirming in a sense what you've said, which is that sociology without history doesn't seem to be able to produce, I think, adequate types of analysis. But that was not true, I think, of an earlier generation of sociologists, and certainly not true of people like Barrington Moore or Max Weber or whoever. So part of my argument this evening is a kind of historical shallowness on the part of a lot of sociology, and that, I think, comes out very specifically in debates about globalization, where again I think Beck and Giddens tend to date globalization from about 1968 or something, whereas I mean the whole debate about globalization can't be simply seen in the context of the spread of electronic information systems. And I mean, part of the reason why I'm trying to create this research group in Singapore around globalization and religion is precisely to look at the concept of world religions as globalizing forces long before the advent of modern electronics. It's not a very adequate answer to your question, but it's partly to agree with the implications of what you're saying. Is I think this notion that Chris Rojak and I try to develop a decorative sociology is a kind of historically shallow type of sociology. We try to argue, I don't know if it works, but we try to argue that the RAE auditing assessment doesn't encourage young scholars to go in for long-term historical explanations, because the actual investment you would have to make in research time is so deep that it's much easier to submit an article on Coronation Street to a cultural studies journal and get it published than to do a very large-scale study of the whole history of popular culture, for example.
Thank you. Question over here. Can you wait for the microphone, sorry?
John Rix. I am just over 80 now, and also a colonial immigrant from Britain. But I've had an interesting life, which has been involved with you. But I think the thing which has most preoccupied me in the last year is this. My friend Ed Tyriakian was asked to guest edit an issue of the journal Comparative Sociology. And he said to me, do something about multiculturalism. I said, what? And he said, well, what are the major issues which have been discussed? But I said, these were the issues, but we are now living in what I call World War IV, in which we have to describe a world in which there's, on the one hand, the coalition of the willing, and on the other hand, a variety of resistance movements being prepared to accept the collateral damage which terrorism involves. And it's understanding that world which everything really has to belong within that today.
Well, I think one of the influential books that's again associated with the LSA is Mary Caldor's book on New and Old Wars, and I think that this has been another major gap, I think, in British sociology is the neglect of war and violence as major mechanisms of social change. And in part, historically, I think that's connected with this idea of gradualism and the absence of civil violence, particularly in Britain, at least of a major sort. But I think that an earlier generation, as I said, of people like Titmuss, I think were only too conscious of the impact of war on social change. And I think the new environment that we're moving into is one in which I think the work of people like Mary Caldor or Hans Joas makes a lot of sense in terms of an analysis of post-bourgeois wars, as it were, and the possible rise of civil conflict and terrorism, I think. And this is kind of paradox of the talk this evening, that in a way we don't want public intellectuals because what produces them is major forms of social violence and militarism and change. It may be that we're better off with sort of homegrown apprentice-style social theorists who do modest pieces of research on the TV, simply because Britain, unlike France and Germany, I don't think has faced sort of these major kind of structural violent changes that have been characteristic of other societies. And elsewhere in Eastern Europe and so forth, produce major intellectuals who had something to say of importance about these issues.
Thank you. Got a question over here.
Jeff Alexander. One little problem and then two observations. I mean, not distinguishing British sociology from public intellectuals is a big conceptual problem. It's very confusing to me. Clearly they're not the same. You name, many, many influential sociologists who you admire, but they're not public intellectuals. There's probably a lot of public intellectuals who aren't sociologists, at least that's true in the United States. But you note that the end of class society and the end of empire are two of the big macro shifts. And I think that they do supply the source of the two major, public theoretical contributions of British sociology. And the first, I would say, is the people who you've been involved with yourself, who introduced from France, which is consistent, the idea of postmodernism into empirical social science. To me, and I think many people outside of Britain, I remember I was in Paris in 93, and the lead article in the French Journal of Sociology was, the term postmodernism is a British invention of five people. What is the idea of postmodernism? It's the end of class society, and it's an attempt to gain a historical purchase on a new period of history, setting up, it's a macro sociology. And you have cultural studies, in a sense, at least in a non-Birmingham way, which PCS does, is about that, with Bauman as the philosopher. And the other successor to empire seems to me globalization theory. And I think Britain is the center of empirical globalization kind of thinking, which is a kind of inversion of empire, an implicit rejection of empire, in terms of cosmopolitanism, etc.
Well, thank you very much for those comments. I mean, the first comment I'm going to make is completely trivial, which is that this attempt to use British sociology as a platform for thinking about public intellectuals has partly
an artificial device of my commitment to the BJS to give a talk of this nature, but I'm going to try and give a much more serious response than that, obviously, which is I think my notion of public intellectual in the context of sociology is an intellectual whose life is committed to a sort of critical understanding of the social in public affairs, in which by the social I mean that whole history that comes down from Durkheim, in which the social is always a sort of moral critique of naked individualism. And sociology, therefore, I think is a critical discipline that has a relatively hostile relationship to individualism and to the neoliberal agenda. And I haven't said it this evening because I'm sort of uncertain about it, but I have this feeling that Catholic societies produce necessarily much better sociology than Protestant ones, because Protestant societies have a great deal of difficulty actually understanding the social. This is why I think in Catholic Europe, social science had a much, as it were, much deeper grounding in the actual culture of those societies. This is why Britain, I think, produces basically very good economic theorists and relatively weak sociological thinkers, because our blood contains, you know, individualism virtually. So I think we have good social anthropology for reasons that are all connected to do with empire. And here again, that's a different sort of story. But I like your connection of class and empire and postmodernism, and I'll just make a couple of comments on it. I mean, I still think the best book on postmodernism is actually Perry Anderson's book, which again I think is a sort of interesting reflection on the impact of the New Left Review team, as it were, on social theory. And I think that what we have failed to do in sociology is really to make a strong distinction between postmodernism as a state of late capitalism and postmodern theory as a way of thinking about that condition. Now, I think postmodern theory has been largely a disaster because it's essentially a sort of take on English literary theory and not very helpful in thinking about the sorts of problems that I think are germane and central to sociology. But postmodernism, I think, is a real issue of a late capitalist society that needs serious attention. I think the globalization debate, again, is very interesting in terms of what we're trying to think about this evening. And there is an argument, again, from historians that really the first wave of globalization came to an end just before the First World War, and that much of what we take to be globalization had actually been created by an international liberal economic market created by the British Empire in terms of a free trade arena. I mean, a very unequal free trade arena, but nevertheless, you could argue, I think, that economic globalization had been produced to some extent by the British Empire, which more or less collapsed around about 1914, 1918, was certainly killed off in 1939, 1940, 1945. And here again, I think that this lack of kind of historical view of globalization amongst sociologists is a real problem, because I think theory, culture, and society has tended to see postmodernism and globalization as a consequence of the growth of worldwide websites and information technology and the electronic revolution. And strangely enough, therefore, has neglected, I think, the cultural dimensions of globalization, which are, to a large extent, I'd want to argue, religious origins, and have ended up with a strangely technologically deterministic view of globalization, that it's something to do with websites, which I think is a very odd position for sociologists to take, in essence. But I think I might put another question back to you, really, which is, I think the differences between American and British sociology are very striking in all of the areas that I've talked about, really. I mean, the historic reluctance of American sociology to talk about social class, I think the current reluctance of American sociology to really engage with the debate about empire, which is coming from British historians like Ferguson or from Marxist sociologists or philosophers like Negri and so forth. And this difference between Northern Europe, Britain and America, I think, is quite important for thinking about the differences in the role of intellectuals in these cultures.
Thank you. question over here.
Thank you. It's a bit of a clarification, actually. If we look at the classical or historical development of civil society, we can see the emergence of public intellectuals, especially in politically in unstable areas and anarchy or dictatorship area, and in revolutionary periods. You also mentioned that sociology found itself kind of a peak, its peak in that kind of a history. Mm-hmm. And then the decline of sociology, as you mentioned, when equality and the social values were challenged or dominated by market society. But then you predict the future sociology for Great Britain. What I was thinking again was that the future sociology in Britain would emerge when the issues of equality and justice come back to the public sphere, or is that what I understood you correctly?
I think if we take French society, the Franco-Prussian War, the First World War, and the crisis of the Second World War produced a huge kind of intellectual questioning about what is France, where is it going, can it survive, etc., etc. And that, I think, produced this long history of sort of Marxist French social theory as a response to what it saw as the crisis of its relationship to Germany. You know, if you think about Durkheim, who spent time in Germany trying to understand the German educational system so he could go back to France and reform France so it could become a modern, you know, vibrant, effective sort of society. I think Germany has had this, you know, debate about Nazism and the Holocaust that underpins the whole Habermasian project, I think, is another kind of illustration of the relationship between massive social change, disturbance, violence, revolution, and so forth, and a really interesting and distinctive sociology. The whole Hungarian legacy that goes with Mannheim and Lukács and so forth, I think, is another. I mean, the Bauman Polish contribution to sociology is yet another. And recently I've been very interested in the concept of generation as a way of thinking about social change. And another way of expressing all of this, and because I've been editing this Cambridge Dictionary of Sociology, which has been a complete nightmare in my life, but I mean, I've read just about every life biography of just about every sociologist born since 1870 or whatever. And this traditional view of the contribution of Jewish migrant intellectuals to sociology is very, very profound. I mean, it's impossible to think about post-war American sociology without that generation, or indeed in the creation of British sociology at Leicester and Leeds and, I don't know, etc., etc. And partly what I'm arguing is that as that generation retired, died, came to an end, it hasn't been replaced by another sort of generation of major intellectuals, certainly in Britain, and I think in America, although I'm only speaking about Britain this evening. And I try to finish the lecture by saying that there are emerging really deep crises, I think, in modern British society that require a sociological response, and that these include, very obviously, I think, race relations, what I want to describe as the failure of multiculturalism, and in a sense, the failure of British citizenship. I mean, because I have dual citizenship in America, in Australia, and currently living in Singapore, I mean, I think a lot about the different experiences of citizenship in these different societies. And I think one thing that's very noticeable is that whereas Australians celebrate citizenship, I mean, it's always on the TV about how good it is to take out Australian citizenship and how
you know, wonderful it is to belong to this Australian community, there's almost no sense, to my mind, of a celebration of an inclusionary British citizenship, at least until about last week, when I think, you know, the British Labour Party suddenly felt that, you know, at that time they did something about this, given the sense of estrangement amongst, you know, most minority communities and so on and so forth. So I'm saying that here is a really big challenge for British sociology, and it creates a kind of niche or a role for the emergence of decisive public intellectuals, because I'm trying to be, in a way, you know, naively sociological about it, in the sense that I don't want to think about intellectual creativity as something to do with psychology or, you know, the creative mind. I think that in crisis, some cultures seem to be able to produce spaces within which intellectual activity takes place, or generations which, because of historical, cultural, social reasons, become the carriers of a great public debate. And it may be that you know, a combination of pandemic, terrorism and civil disturbance might just about catapult British sociology into being an independent, decisive public set of intellectuals working on this range of problems.
Thank you. There's a question over here.
My name is Max Steuer. I'm a bit genuinely puzzled by your core thesis, as I understand it. You seem to be saying, at least this is how I read it, that British sociology has suffered from a lack of big events, to put it crudely. At the same time, you're saying, yes, but there was a big event, the loss of empire, and nobody responded. So what is it really? I mean, have I got it completely wrong, or is there a sort of contradiction in what you're saying?
I think there's a deliberate paradox. I think there's a strong argument to say, following my Rumney thesis, that major crisis at least creates opportunities for public intellectuals to seriously engage with the nature of what it is to be British, French, German, or whatever, or a citizen, or part of humanity. I agree with you. Then I say that, in a sense, there was a big event, which was the disappearance of empire, but that, I don't think, produced this crisis because of the Macmillan pragmatic response to loss of empire, which I think was driven by liberal economic values, which said, in a sense, we can't make a profit out of sustaining the old colonial structure, so we'll let it collapse and then carry on business as usual, but by other means, as it were, and have, as it were, a kind of secret colonial economic relationship. And I think that because I would argue that Britain in particular was exhausted by First World War conflict, the Depression, and then another war. And I think the mood of British society was really this passive consumerism, that class-ridden prosperity was better than what they'd had. And I think, you know, that I'm the classic product of this. I mean, my grandfather was a coal miner, my parents were waiters and waitresses, and I became professor of sociology at Cambridge. And that was a sort of the post-war adjustment from empire to consumerism. And I suppose what I'm saying in the paper, it's rather difficult to be heroically intellectual about consumerism, you know, because one, it's difficult to get excited about Nike, I don't think, unless you're into debates about exploitative labour relations in wherever, India or the Third World and so forth. So your question is a very good one. I was aware of it in trying to write this paper, but I'm interested in paradoxes, and I hope it's not a contradiction.
Question here in the middle.
Yes, going back to Edward Said and his definition of intellectuals, those who speak truth to power, I just wanted to ask, I mean, current intellectuals and past intellectuals, are they satisfied with what power is doing to Britain, or has been, or will be? That's the first question. And the second thing. I guess what I'm really saying is any discipline or any role, I mean, either grows or declines subject to the forces of supply and demand. So are you saying that the demand for both intellectuals and sociology as a discipline is on a declining curve or an increasing curve? I guess I understand the paradox now a little bit better, but could you comment on this, please? Thank you.
Well, on the first point, I mean, I suppose I'm reluctant to be critical of Edward Said because he's, in a way, like the role model of what an intellectual ought to look like. And, I mean, his thesis is not unlike what I've been trying to say, namely that in his autobiography, I mean, he places this great emphasis on the idea of exile as a condition of intellectuality, that, you know, it's the estrangement that intellectuals feel from the cultures that become their hosts that drives them into the need to speak truth to power or whatever. And so, I mean, I think Said's own sense of subjective exile from his own cultural roots produces this intellectual response that comes out in Orientalism and so on and so forth. I mean, I think the problem with Said's argument is it's difficult, I think, to think of Said as someone who's marginalized in American culture, because he was professor in one of the most prestigious positions in comparative literature, but leave that to one side. I think the supply and demand argument may work quite well. I haven't been very often to China, but when I have been, I've always been struck by the great resurgence of social science from a position of sort of zero, and conscious of the kind of depth of intellectual debate in current China about what to do with minority groups. What is Chinese society? Is it still a tributary empire? How will they build a nation state? What will they do with their great emerging wealth? What are the urban problems they're going to have to face with? How to deal with SARS, AIDS, HIV? I mean, it's just kind of an endless set of very large-scale problems. And I, when I speak to Chinese sociologists, I get a sense of excitement and, I don't know, exuberance and a kind of seriousness that I often miss in other cultures. And I'm currently fortunate enough to have about five or six postgraduate Chinese students who are just stunningly, you know, sort of serious and intellectual about wanting to do sociology. And one of them said to me the other day, "I love sociology." Now, I haven't heard anybody say that for a very long time, but it was greatly liberating and uplifting, and I was very pleased. So there is a kind of demand and supply side of it that I'm, you know, I think China needs sociologists because the social problems are so massive that it can't solve them by historians or economists or geographers or anybody else. And the same sort of argument, I think, applies to places like Turkey, about which I know a little bit, which is, again, I think the huge contradictions between secularism and religious revival and their relations to Europe, their problems of trying to reorganize themselves to face Europe and the legacy of Ataturk and all that, seems to produce a very vibrant group of not only sociologists, but public intellectuals. And, you know, it's just, I don't know, one gets a kind of great sense of cosmopolitan effervescence in a place like Istanbul that I think is producing very interesting sociologists, and people in the room can probably supply rather similar sorts of issues. I've always thought, in a way, the problem of British culture is this legacy of liberalism, that the market will always somehow find an answer to these problems. And this is why, just to give two illustrations, I think the development of the idea of British citizenship, I think, is very late in the game, so to speak. I think it's 1948, the Aliens Act, that begins to really shape the notion of what it is to be British. Prior to that, I think, it was a sort of taken-for-granted set of assumptions about Englishness that was shaping the emergence of the nation state. So, I mean, whilst Britain has been a nation state for, I don't know, a long time, I think the concept of British citizenship is a very late sort of development. Why? Because I think the underlying assumption is always that social problems can be solved by market efficiency, or that social problems can be solved if you've got enough growth in the economy. And we still live in that sort of environment, I think, particularly British universities, which, as we all know, I think are largely dominated by these sorts of debates. So we don't have a clear view of truth or value, but we have a good sense of price, as it were.
And I think that's the sort of liberal legacy in public debate here, and why it is that, generally speaking, people don't want to hear what sociologists or geographers or historians have to say, but they're very interested in either what the medical solutions to social problems or the liberal economic solutions to them.
Okay, I can have two very quick last questions. I'm going to have to ignore some hands. I'm sorry, they all went up at the end.
I'll
have one at the back here.
Unless
we take all the questions
in,
then I'll just
Michael O'Donnell, you've made one or two oblique references to the failure of multiculturalism. I wondered, are you looking for that to be the possible missing crisis? That, and if so, would you see a solution along national cultural inclusiveness? I would have thought the inclusiveness might be more in the area of human rights than a national culture.
Okay, another question front here. Sorry, all the side.
My name is Jim Kennedy. Professor Turner, one of the laments that you expressed, if I can use the term, for British sociology, has to do with the lack of political relevance. This leads on, in my mind at least, to what is rather current in the literature of sociology today, the lack of attention to social policy. And it seems to me that what you cite in regard to sociology is a manifestation of something much more general affecting many other disciplines. For example, some people have suggested that one of the top priorities today for social policy should be the study of global terrorism. And it seems to me that what is happening within the university world, you are finding the breakdown of departmental barriers, the blurring of boundaries, the creation of centers, the creation of institutes which are multidisciplinary in their nature. So I think many disciplines are experiencing, to a degree, what you cited with respect to sociology.
And there's a final question at the back here.
David Bartram, since it will be clear that I'm also not a British sociologist, I hope I can be forgiven for a question that might verge on the naive. You framed the problem as one in which British sociology has essentially failed to understand the decline of British society, and I wonder if that doesn't posit a false premise. I'm wondering in particular what this idea of the decline of British society is. It seems to me that you can talk about other countries catching up, you can certainly talk about the loss of empire, but in terms of decline, as an outsider having moved here, it's not really clear to me what this is, especially if it's discussed in the sense of a decline into consumerism. In other words, it seems that there's some sort of vision of an ideal society behind what you're saying, and it's the failure to reach that ideal that constitutes a failure of some sort. And I'm wondering if the failure isn't simply this idea that we're positing an ideal that just doesn't exist in this context.
Well, I'll try and answer all three questions really by saying that the underlying agenda here is the sociology of citizenship, which is a topic I've been associated with for some time. And my current interest is really the question about can multiculturalism survive in a range of different societies, and I'm particularly interested in Southeast Asia and Asia and the whole future of Indonesia, for example, as a viable integrated system. And in response to the gentleman at the back, I mean, my underlying kind of interest is whether an affective sense of membership through citizenship institutions can provide enough, as it were, social glue for modern society to exist as a viable set of institutions is a kind of question behind what I've been saying this evening, the implicit question. And what I was kind of hinting at, I suppose, was that the early wave of post-war British sociologists, the Titmuss, the Marshalls and the Keynes and so forth, seemed to me to be essentially concerned with trying to rebuild British society on the basis of welfare, citizenship and redistribution. And this, I think, was the bread and butter of much of British sociology, indeed the LSE's project, as it were. And I think that has become, that's come unraveled for various reasons, to do with the legacy of Thatcherism, the neoliberal
experiment, the globalization of labor markets and so on and so forth. So I don't think I necessarily have a vision of an ideal society, but I do have a sort of normative sociological view of the need for collective institutions, public spaces, the sharing of experiences and so forth, if you're going to have anything that resembles a society. And this is why I think Mrs. Thatcher's rather, I don't know, eye-catching expression about there is no such thing as society, there's only individuals and their families, actually touched a very raw nerve in sort of the history of British liberalism, and was a real challenge to British sociology at the time, because it really was saying, in a sense, you know, sociology has no role in the society that I'm creating, because the only things that are going to exist really are individuals buying services, and there will be no institutional base. And I think if I was to put this in the American context, I'd say New Orleans ought to create a whole new school of sociology, because I think it demonstrates the failure of investment in levies, the failure of investment in infrastructure, and the lack of preparedness of an individualistic society to respond to really what is a collective crisis. And I think the comparisons people have been making between responses to the tsunami disaster and the New Orleans one are quite interesting from a sociological point of view. And I gather the ASA has put out a call for major research on the New Orleans crisis. I don't wish a New Orleans crisis on the Suffolk Fens, but I think that Britain will have to face up to some fairly massive structural adjustments, which I think are very much to do with citizenship, identity and race. And, you know, the younger people in this audience hopefully will be those sociologists that take us into the next generation and the next paradigms, hopefully.
Thank you very much, Brian. That was certainly provocative, and we hope that we'll pursue this one in the coming year. I should reiterate Brian's thanks to Jackie Gauntlett, who organised this this evening, did all the fine detail which made it all work. We've got Brian here on time, I think, in part. And finally, to thank you all for coming, and to invite you for drinks afterwards. The licensing laws, much more my area, mean that we have to move buildings, so we have to move back to the main LSE campus and go to the atrium, but there will be signs showing you how to go there. But please can we thank Brian first, and hope to see you in a moment at the atrium.